Welcome to Derm Discussions. Last month, Dr. Brad Glick spoke with Dr. Valerie Callender on cosmetic practices in dermatology. They touched on procedures related to hair removal, hair loss, and fillers, to name a few. For this episode, Dr. Glick continues this conversation with board-certified dermatologist Dr. Rebecca Kazin, who offered insights into cosmetic procedures performed in her own practice. Drawing from her clinical and training experiences, Dr. Kazin lent some advice on use of dermal fillers, including differences in injectables, best application practices, and ways to ensure optimal patient satisfaction. She also discussed her experiences with skin tightening procedures, cryolipolysis, and microneedling, offering pearls of wisdom for the dermatologist seeking to diversify and hone their approaches to cosmetic care. And finally, Dr. Kazin talked about a hair product that she developed for the scalp, describing its inception, purpose, and dermatologic potential. So, without further ado, let me hand it off to Dr. Glick. Enjoy.
Welcome to Derm Discussions, April 2021 Dermatology Podcast from HCP Live. I'm Dr. Brad Glick, and I'm your host. Our topic today is current trends in cosmetic dermatology, new devices, new technologies. And joining me today is Dr. Rebecca Kazin, who is a board-certified dermatologist in private practice. Dr. Kazin is a nationally recognized expert in cosmetic dermatologic surgery and currently serves as the Director of Clinical Research at Icon Dermatology and Aesthetics in Rockville, Maryland. Her extensive experience as an injector and trainer has earned her a seat on multiple national advisory boards. Additionally, she continues her love of teaching as a local and national clinical trainer. Dr. Kazin has authored manuscripts and textbook chapters on these and other related topics, and she continues to pursue her interests in cutting-edge clinical research as the principal investigator for multiple FDA phase 3 and phase 4 studies. Lastly, but certainly not least, seeing a treatment gap in available therapies for hair care, Dr. Kazin has formulated a patented medicated shampoo and conditioner system that is currently being brought to market, which we'll be very excited to talk about today. Dr. Kazin, thank you for being here. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
I want to just dive right in, and I want you to start by just telling me a little bit about your practice, the setup, its design and flow. Maybe even share with us kind of where you came from and then what you're doing right now in your practice. Then we'll talk about cosmetic procedures.
Sure. So I feel very fortunate that I've seen kind of a full spectrum of different types of practices. I started, as you said, at Hopkins. I did my training there, and then I stayed on as faculty and was the medical director of the cosmetic center for 9 years. And I enjoyed that very much. I just love the camaraderie of the department and teaching the residents. I then joined Dr. Tina Alster in private practice. So just a very different model. Private practice in general taught me that small stealth practices can make quick shifts, which was something definitely a large institution like Hopkins had difficulty with. It was also the first time that I didn't take insurance, which was very interesting. It's sort of a double-edged sword. You feel slightly guilty, but yet your personal quality of life, not shifting through pounds of paperwork at the end of the day, was great as I have children. I worked with Tina for 7 years, and just during COVID, due to some circumstances outside of my control, myself and the other associate that were there went into practice together, and we opened Icon Dermatology in September of 2020. It's set up very similarly to what I did when I worked with Tina. It's a purely fee-for-service based practice. Right now, it's just myself and her. We don't have any other extenders. And right now with COVID, we're still booking one per hour and we try to limit overlap. So I'm 3 days in the office and she's 3 days in the office and we overlap one day
What does practice look like for you now, you know, maybe compared to, I guess, you know, you started in September, kind of in the height of it all, which is unbelievable that you're able to really pull that off. Are you doing mostly live? Are you doing telemedicine right now?
I would say I'm 97% live. I mean, I feel like we all do telemedicine. I mean, I get so many texts and emails and things of people's rashes and everything, but I'm not really doing any sort of billing patients for telemedicine. There are some patients who, before really people started getting vaccinated, or elderly patients did not feel comfortable coming in. So yes, I would FaceTime with them, but it's really not very common. Most of the time people are coming in for procedures, and that's kind of hard to do remotely. I did meet one gentleman outside. Actually, I met him, he was in the car, and I brought out my liquid nitrogen gun. So...
That's great.
Yeah.
Well, let's jump in and kind of talk generally first in your particular practice, but just what cosmetic procedures do you do in your practice? Kind of what's hot, what's not, what devices do you have in your practice? Why don't you share that with us, and then we can get into a little bit more detail.
So just full disclosure, I have to say filler, just dermal fillers in general, are my absolute favorite thing to do. I always joke, like, if I didn't need a job, I'd probably still do them on the side of the road, because there is nothing like the immediate gratification of slight contour change to someone's face, restoring symmetry. I think I was always sort of destined to that, even though I didn't realize it. I've always been somebody, my mother's an artist and my father is an accountant. And so that right brain, left brain, but I'm fascinated by filler. So I find that my patients tend to be filler patients, yet the other doctor I work with, she's more of a laser person. So it's just sort of works out that way. We both do both, but I'm telling you, I'm probably 70% injectables on and off of the face.
I really enjoy doing cosmetic procedures myself. I'm not a cosmetic dermatologist as you, but I agree with you completely that fillers specifically, but fillers and Botox, just those two together, you can be such an artist if you just take the time to do so. So yeah. Tell us some pearls, some tips that you have when you're injecting, what particular type of fillers you like to use in particular settings, what you use in your practice.
So, you know, it pretty much had started with the hyaluronic acid fillers back in the day. I mean, gosh, Restylane, I remember I finished residency in 2005, and we were just starting to learn Restylane, and everyone was filling the nasolabial folds. And then we, you know, realized that we could completely obliterate the nasolabial folds, but it didn't necessarily make anybody look better. In fact, it started making people look very strange. And I just find it fascinating, the whole sort of evolution of understanding aging of the face that goes all the way down to the bone, and kind of looking at the plastic surgery literature and understanding the skeletal changes and how we can restore that underlying structure. So in general, I mostly use hyaluronic acid, especially if somebody has never had filler before. I feel like with any sort of doctor-patient relationship, but certainly a cosmetic patient, you're entering into almost like a marriage with this patient. And you want to make sure that this person is reasonable and has reasonable expectations. And so to put in something that maybe can't be dissolved or may have a longer relationship with this person, I don't want to do. So I always start with hyaluronic acid. I do tend to use the other products, namely polylactic acid. I use a ton. And calcium hydroxylapatite, which I do both as is, dilute, and hyperdilute. In general, I would say I do a lot of training for filler. I generally tell my trainees it's best to first address the perimeter of the face. You can think of it as like a frame. And when you restore the frame, you can then deal with the center. But if you deal with the center first, you will distort natural proportions, because the issue most of the time is happening back here. And so by focusing back here, you will be able to put less in the front and you will maintain proportions. You know, I'm always, as soon as I do a consult with someone, I'm starting off at the top. Like, I look at their top third, I look at their middle third, I look at their bottom third, and then I have them turn and I look at them from the side and I, you know, assess their jaw projection. And I really, I love to do that. But at the end of the day, if there is an eye for it. But I start it like that because in my mind, then I sort of can try to see what the patient is bothered by. And then I try to see what's causing it and how close can I come to fixing the primary problem? Because I think that gets you the best result.
Tell us a little bit about how you, for instance, polyalactic acid, what's your concoction? How do you like to approach this? I know there's a little bit of a difference between injectors, where you like to place it, who the appropriate candidate is for that. And then we'll talk maybe about a couple of the other fillers and then maybe move on.
Yeah, so polyalactic acid really has had its renaissance because polyalactic acid, as you know, came out, I mean, I think I was still in residency. I think it was 2003, maybe. I was doing it on HIV patients who were compliant with their medicine for lipoatrophy. And back then, we were doing the on-label 4cc dilution with a little bit of lidocaine. And then we realized when we were using it in cosmetic patients who had a competent immune system, people were having nodules and things like that. There was this issue. And so it's always been with polyalactic acid that you were reconstituting it a few days in advance, and that was maybe what was happening with the nodules. Well, then they figured out it's not the time to reconstitute. It's actually the volume of reconstitution. So now, believe it or not, they're getting this to be on label. It's not quite yet. I reconstitute it same day. I used to reconstitute it a week before. So same day, and now I reconstitute with 8 cc's of water and 1 cc of lidocaine. You can reconstitute the day before, but don't add the lidocaine. Don't add lidocaine until the person's there and has agreed to do it. And so that's how I do it for the face. When I do it for the body, I double that.
And what is your volume usage? You know, I guess there used to be the old adage, what, one vial per decade?
Right.
Exactly. Yeah. Still go by that? Is it a couple of vials per session or just varies?
Yeah, so I don't really go vial per decade because, first of all, I have learned, because I actually do a little bit of PMMA, polymethyl methacrylate, and they sell the kits. And if you start telling patients where I work that they need a kit, 5 syringes, they'll just say, thank you very much, and walk out the door. Because that freaks them out, and they must think you're the wrong doctor for them. But yet, if I give them like 1 syringe every month for 5 months, they don't think that's a problem. So again, it's a bit of a mental. So I generally, with polyalactic acid, I start with 2 vials, because I have found that if I start with less than that, the first result is not that great, and then the person loses confidence in the product. So I start with 2 vials, and then I bring them back at least 6 weeks later, usually 6 to 8 weeks, and then likely do another vial or 2, depends how wasted they have, how much wasting they have. And then I just do 1 vial, 1 vial, until we reach the point where both of us are happy. You know, on average, people probably get 5 vials spaced over time. But I tell people you can space it out 3 months, because financially and just with scheduling. But some of my most favorite transformations are with polyalactic acid, because it's the closest thing to fat, and I don't do fat transfer.
And what is the longevity? What do you tell your patients? How long is that going to last?
Well, I tell them it's at least 2 years, because as you know, with these studies, they just stopped counting at 2 years, and they still had efficacy at 2 years. So it's at least 2 years, but I also don't want to be misleading. It's not like they're going to look like this exactly at 2 years, because the clock continues to tick. So I generally tell them they could expect to come in maybe once a year for a vial. Plus, they're going to be getting their probable neuromodulators and some hyaluronic acid, because we can't do this in tear trough and, you know, around the mouth. So I'm seeing them anyway.
Just my optic, I feel like with hyaluronic acid gels, I have more control and I can kind of be artistic, because with polyalactic acid, then I kind of find like it's kind of a little bit of wait and see. Now, obviously you do a tremendous amount of it, and it is a really, really unique product. And I think the long-term results, barring complications, have been phenomenal in our patients.
You know, now the way I really use Sculptra is not so much to contour, because I agree. I think for contouring, it's not my favorite, because I have found that some patients build a lot of collagen with it and some patients don't. And it's hard for me sometimes to figure out who those are. So for contouring, I'm generally using HAs or calcium hydroxylapatite. I love Sculptra for skin quality. So the etched lines here, which actually we're finishing up one of the studies for that, the etched lines here, there's not much else that you can use to kind of help with the etched lines. I love it to try to put back in the preauricular cheek to pull back. So things like that I really like it for. And then I do like it for areas on the body, like I've done it in the décolleté, the knees, the upper inner arms, where you really want, it has zero G prime, right? So you just want collagen. And I don't even tell patients it's a filler anymore. I tell them it's a collagen treatment.
I tell patients it's a process as well.
Exactly.
Because it's not that immediate gratification always that we get with hyaluronic acid gels. Well, listen, Dr. Kaysen, we could talk all day about fillers, right, which is unbelievable. I do have one last question about fillers, however. Cannulas or needles? What do you do?
So I tell people, why do I have to choose? And I don't. So I'm probably, if I had to say, 80% cannula, 20% needle. In general, I'm doing cannula for most areas, unless I'm doing a needle down to bone in the temple with polylactic acid, and I'm still a needle in the lip. But I'm only 25 gauge in the face, no 27 gauge. And in the body, I'm a 22 gauge.
I want to shift gears a little bit here. Tell us about, you know, sagging skin, tightening procedures. What's been your experience with, let's say, I'll put it out there, radiofrequency, combinations of radiofrequency with maybe microneedling? Do you do some of these procedures in your practice? And if so, which ones? And just kind of talk about the benefits to our patients, what the availability is, and again, what those benefits are to our patients.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say that's one of the most common things, especially the jawline and neck. And it's still an area where I don't feel like, as non-invasive or minimally invasive practitioners, that I have all the answers. And I certainly still send people for surgery. But obviously, we have a biased population because they're coming to us because, in general, they don't think they're ready for surgery. They don't want surgery. So I go through this process from sort of most conservative to most invasive, kind of how I talk about hair loss and their options for that. So, you know, I talk about least invasive. I talk about devices like microfocused ultrasound, monopolar radio frequency. And that's what I did the most of when I was with Tina. I tell them that they should expect about 20 to 30% improvement. I tell them if surgery is 100%, which we know it's not, but if you call that 100%, then you could expect 20 to 30% of that. I'm very honest. Then I tell them there's another option because I do threads. Right now I'm doing the Silhouette Instalift threads. And so I tell them that that's potentially more like 40 to 50% improvement, but I go over what involves that. And then I tell them more than that I don't do, but that I could refer them to see my colleague who potentially would do something that goes a cannula or laser under the skin, radio frequency versus surgery. So, you know, something like a thermi or a face tight, which we don't do right now.
Do you find that when we're dealing with the jawline, the neck, the submental region, that it's really about combination therapy?
100%. You know,
Kybella is a product that in our world came to market, reasonable responses. But what I found with most of my patients is that we needed to be able to combine it with something else, something that would give a little bit of tightening. Do you find that in your experience and your partner's experiences that you're having to do, you know, multiple procedures, whether it be something semi-invasive or minimally invasive, maybe a tightening procedure, and then something like a Kybella?
100%. So I agree. I mean, Kybella is another one that I actually was fortunate enough to be the PI at Hopkins for that study back in the day for submental fullness. It's hard though, because those studies, they don't like to work with institutional IRBs because they're so slow, which was also interesting getting into private practice. But I did it to myself for my own little bit of submental fullness about 7-8 years ago. But what I really love it for are the jowls. And I was terrified to do that because in the study, they told us not to put it there, that we were going to get marginal mandibular issues. And I finally talked to enough dermatologists that I trust, and I do it. And it's probably my highest satisfaction procedure, even though the results are subtle in photos, but in person, it really does help dissolve this jowl fat pad that is slid down and obscuring the jawline. And knock wood, I haven't had any issues with it, but I do warn them about the the 3 to 4 days of significant swelling, and I tell them it's permanent, and usually it's one, maybe two treatments. So I will say with this area, I first make sure if I need to debulk. So if I need to debulk, I'm using Kybella or cryolipolysis first. Then I decide if I need to resurface. And if I need to resurface, I'm using fractionated, non-ablative devices. I also do use radiofrequency microneedling. And then I also do hyperdilute either calcium hydroxylapatite, or I have used dilute hyaluronic acid in the neck itself. And then I'll use an energy device. I mean, it's kind of a little bit overwhelming. So I try to figure out the overlying problem and fix that. So is it laxity? Is it fat? Is it texture? Is it like that crepey skin? And so I'd say the most common thing I do for just this area, which I have the problem now, is I do the hyperdilute filler and I do RF microneedling over it. That's my newest thing that I'm doing right now.
Can you share the technique of dilution for the calcium hydroxyapatite?
Yeah, so I do, you know, literally I take the syringe, which is 1.5 cc's, and then I pull up 1.5 cc's of bacteriostatic saline. Now make sure you pull it up in a 3 cc syringe, because when you squirt the 1.5 in, you're going to pop the plunger off. So that sucks when that happens. So push it into the 3 cc and then make sure you put another 3 cc on the other side. So, and then you swish back and forth. That makes a 1-to-1, which in filler speak is just dilute radius. If you're talking about hyperdilute, it's anything over 1-to-1. So then what you do is you take another 1.5 cc's and you swish it into your now 3 cc dilution. Now you've made it 1-to-2. So in the neck, because usually these are thin-skinned people, I use 1-to-3. So I'm adding 4.5 cc's of bacteriostatic saline to a 1.5 cc solution. But don't add it in all at once. Add in 1.5 slow, like each time, or else it doesn't really mix very well. That's how I do my hyperdilution.
So it's done in succession?
I do it in succession.
Well, we can't escape fillers. We always circle back to fillers. I do want to ask you a little bit about cryolipolysis. Do you do that in your practice? Are you guys doing
Yes.
that in your practice?
Yes.
And where are the most common regions where you're using cryolipolysis? I know that, you know, it's always been the abdominal fat pad region, the pannus, et cetera, but are you doing it off of the abdomen? Where else are you using this procedure?
I mean, I love it for this area, we do it here. I won't name the handpiece, but anyway, we do it here, but usually we do an overlap. So like one goes right about here and one goes right about here and they overlap in the middle, but that one's a little hard to sit through because you have to sit very still for a period of time. We do what women lovingly call our bra fat. So like right in here, which I did on myself 2 years ago, we do this part of the arm, inner thighs, outer thighs, back fat, you know, flanks, like muscle muffin tops. I mean, pretty much most areas now. I'm not a big, like, I don't do knees a lot. Like, if I'm doing a small area like that, I'll just do deoxycholic acid. But for anything bigger, and sometimes you can debulk with cryolipolysis and then finish up with deoxycholic acid.
Yeah, there's a lot of off-site use of, if you will, deoxycholic acid. You brought it up again, our friend Kybella. And we can interchange the names, of course, what have you. You know, being that we're audio here, too, and you said here and here and here.
Oh, sorry.
It's okay. Just for the audience, I think it's really important because, you know, kind of submental and neck. And I think there's a lot of versatility for cryolipolysis. But again, as you mentioned before, when you talked about radio frequency, let's take that area as example, the cervical region, submental region, even that kind of pregeal area. If you're doing cryolipolysis, what kind of percentage improvement are you sharing with your patients that they can achieve?
Well, I tell them that it does reduce the number of fat cells in that area by about 20%. Now, usually what happens is they come in, and I tend to see mostly baby boomers still. So, you know, I'm not seeing really young millennials yet in where I practice. It tends to be people who have like sort of bigger necks, and I pinch the skin and I try to determine in my head what percentage I think is skin and what percentage I think is fat. Because if it's mostly skin, for example, I make up a number like 70% skin and 30% fat, 20% of 30% is not going to be that noticeable. So I go through this whole thing, and then I tell them that I don't think that fat reduction is the way to go. And that's kind of how I go over it. But if I'm pinching and I don't feel like it's mostly skin, then I will start with fat reduction. And I tell them this 20% number, but I do tell them that for all areas I do, it's pretty amazing that you're sitting there doing nothing for 30 to 60 minutes and 20% of your fat cells in an area are gone. And as you know, we don't make any more fat cells after adolescence. So even if your weight does go up and down, which of course it will, that area will never get as big because it doesn't have as many fat cells. So I think when you explain it to people, it's still pretty amazing. And if you pick the right patient, meaning they have to have superficial fat, it has to be pinchable. If you see those people with hard bellies, that's visceral fat and you're not getting there. And the same thing with the neck, which I found somebody taught me, which I love, is you have them engage their platysma. And if you can still feel the fat, that is pre-platysmal fat, that is treatable. If you can't feel the fat, that's post-platysmal fat, say that five times, you cannot treat that with cryolipolysis or deoxycholic acid.
It seems to me like cryolipolysis as a procedure has really had a renaissance, use that word before too, because we are using it off of the more common areas for which it was originally invented, which I think is fabulous for our patients. Once again, we can be artistic, we can sculpt the face and other areas. So I think it's wonderful. I want to shift. We're going to go two more topics here. In your practice, are you doing microneedling? And if so, are you doing microneedling with PRP? Do you do PRP? And what do you use PRP for?
So I do microneedling. I have to say most of my microneedling is radiofrequency microneedling. I absolutely love that device for scars because you can use it in any skin color. Although I haven't used it in like type 5-6, but I see a lot of type 4. And so I use it in those patients. Type 5-6, I generally use the microneedling without heat first and then maybe with heat. But there is such an immediate improvement with atrophic acne scars. And what I'll do with that is I call it a collagen sandwich. They have atrophic acne scars on their cheeks. I do subcision and I do hyperdilute polymethyl methacrylate under the area, not in the actual scars, but under it, like I'm glazing a donut underneath. And then the same day, I do the radiofrequency microneedling over top, and it really like turbo boosts them. And it's really, I tell people two, maybe three treatments, but I space them 2 to 3 months apart because I want their body to do the work so that they'll need less of them. And I've seen some really amazing improvement. Regular microneedling, I do, but I usually do that for just very focal things. I have to say my associate who I work with, she does more regular microneedling, and my prior boss, Dr. Ulster, she loves microneedling, regular microneedling. But I found in my hands, I got the best result with radiofrequency microneedling. I don't do a ton of microneedling just for rejuvenation because we do low energy fractionated non-ablative treatments, but you could. I personally don't believe that there's any literature to suggest that microneedling plus PRP, the PRP part helps the microneedling except for help it heal faster. So to tell someone they're going to pay this extra fee for the PRP, I give them the option, but I usually don't do it. I do love PRP for androgenetic alopecia. I use it all the time. I do think it works. We do a series of 4 treatments spaced a month apart. And we are doing 22 cc blood draws. And with that, you get about 9 to 10 cc's of PRP. I'm not doing anything fancy. I don't microneedle the scalp. I don't put on any fancy serums. But I just do small. I use like a 31 gauge needle. And I do small, like 0.2 to 0.5 cc aliquots in like a grid-like pattern.
How long will that hold them for before they need more?
So after they do the series, I tell them maintenance is different for everyone. You know, the studies sort of make you do like one per quarter. So I have them come back in 3 months. I do that for like 2 treatments. And then I see if we can space it to 6 months. With this, though, I tell them that I explain to them how PRP works. I explain to them how a follicle ages and what this will do. That first, it will decrease shedding. Then, as it rejuvenates the follicle, the hair that comes out will be thicker and healthier and shinier. Last, it will help regrow hair. That is the hardest thing to do. So I tell them that whole thing. That's why my patients generally are happy with it. And I almost always have them on something else because I tell them that this is not permanent. Even if they get a hair transplant, which I don't do, they still have to do something. So I have them either on one of the oral nutraceuticals. I do use prescription finasteride, even in women, or spironolactone, topical minoxidil. I have had good results with oral finasteride in postmenopausal women.
Same here. I think it's a very good choice, and I really appreciate the information on PRP. I just got some pearls, so I appreciate that from me. Speaking of hair, speaking of PRP, speaking of androgenetic alopecia, in the subject of hair, you've developed a line of hair care products. I want you to tell us about Hair Sanity. I'm excited to know about it. I've kind of been a little sneaky and looked it up online. Please share with us in the time remaining how you got this together. What was your interest in doing so, and what's happening with it?
You know, it's interesting now because I remember when I had this idea. Now thinking back, I can't believe it was 10 years ago in 2011, July 4th weekend. And it's been such a process that I have to say any other physicians interested in launching a product, I'm happy to talk about it because I've had ups and downs. I used to think it was like a child of mine. Now I think it's like a boyfriend that keeps breaking up with me and like breaking my heart and I keep going back to him. But it's like a labor of love because this has been devastating, exciting, happy, sad. I've been taken advantage of, you know, all of it. It's a learning curve. But basically, I had this idea where I was having a ton of patients come in not happy with dandruff products, very simple. And I would give them the prescription ketoconazoles. I'd give them the clobetasol scalp solution and all that. And it was messy and it smelled bad and it made their hair, they didn't want to use it. And so I was like, I thought, why is there no over-the-counter hydrocortisone washout? That's all how it started. It took me a long time to find a cosmetic chemist. I did. We formulated it in a really prestige level shampoo with hydrocortisone, filed a patent. Many years later was issued the patent. That was a whole rigmarole. And I was launching it myself. And then I met someone who I eventually kind of hired on as the CEO and gave him control because at the time I had tried doing it myself and believed that because he had a business background, could do it better than I can. Long story short, that was not the case. And I've spent the past year and a half getting out of that and redoing it myself now. And now I'm partners with my manufacturer and we're doing it ourselves. And actually, just 2 weeks ago, I found out that I will be on QVC with the product. So basically, it is a hydrocortisone-based washout luxury level shampoo and a salicylate based luxury level conditioner. And we did studies. Zoe Dralos did my study head to head with Head and Shoulders. And yeah, that's where
we can use it for dry scalp. We can use it for seborrheic dermatitis. Yeah. It seems to me like it's a no brainer for using in patients with psoriasis, perhaps the hardest form of psoriasis to treat in my camp. So I'm so excited about this. And, you know, as we wind down, I just have to say to you, thank you. This has been perhaps one of the most engaging derm discussions that we have had since we launched last year. Dr. Case and I, thank you so much for being with us today. This was absolutely fantastic. And I really want to bring you back. I wish you great success, not only in your new practice, how challenging that was opening in the midst of a pandemic, but it sounds like you're doing great. And I wish you the very, very best of luck with that. Thank you so much for your time with us today. And to the audience, we very much look forward to seeing you again and hearing from you and being with you again in May. So thank you so much, Dr. Case.
And thank you so much for having me.
To listen to more Derm Discussions with Dr. Brad Glick, check out our other episodes on iTunes and Spotify. And be sure to visit us at hcplive.com. for up-to-date research, conference coverage, and physician perspectives. Stay tuned for all the latest and hottest trends and topics in dermatology. Until next month.